Hey, listeners, it's 2024, and we are so excited for everything ahead this year. If you haven't done so already, make sure to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders, where you can get access to bonus episodes. We've already released 18 of them, and they come out twice a month. Plus, you can get access to ad-free episodes and our private Discord server to hang out with other members of the CashLack community. That's patreon.com/curbsiders. You know, Paul, a person with no head or neck is just not capable.
Capable of what?
Like you can't put a cape on
them?
Okay,
with the cape. Gotcha. All right, that's not bad. So I went on a journey instead of finding a pun, and I hesitate to share this with you, but the first thing that auto completed was turtleneck jokes. And there are actually the 13 Instagram captions for all of your trendy turtleneck pics, which I was tempted to go through. But let me ask you this, Matt.
Okay.
Why don't tortoises wear scarves?
I don't know.
Because they have turtlenecks.
There you go. That's good.
Thanks.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity, aside from possibly CashLack Memorial Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders. I'm Dr. Matthew Frankwato, here with my great friend and America's primary care physician, Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Matt. Classic greeting. How are you?
I'm doing well. And on tonight's show, we discuss neck pain with Dr. Anthony Makula. And Paul, before we get to the topic, can you remind people, what is it that we do on the Curbsiders?
Sure, Matt. As a reminder to our listeners, we are the internal medicine podcast. We use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. And Matt, as you mentioned, we talked to Dr. Anthony Makula about all things neck pain. Do you want me to tell you more about him?
Yeah, I would love to learn more about him.
So he is in his, I think we established 74th year of postgraduate training. So Dr. Makula is an enfolded spine fellow, which is an unfortunate name, but he's in his final year of neurosurgery residency at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. During residency, he completed an enfolded fellowship in spinal oncology at MD Anderson with Dr. Lawrence Rhines. And next year, he will complete a post-residency fellowship, because he did not get enough training, in spinal deformity and spine tumor with Dr. Chris Ames at the University of California, San Francisco. He will then return to be staff at Mayo Clinic as a neurosurgery spine surgeon who treats all aspects of spine surgery with specific expertise in spinal deformity and spinal tumors. In this episode, he teaches us about the very common presentations of neck pain. So we go through mechanical neck pain and what to do about that and how it will typically go. We talk about cervical radiculopathy and its classical presentation and possible options there. And then importantly, we talk about how to recognize cervical myelopathy, which is probably under-recognized in primary care clinics or diagnosed too late. So he gave us a lot of great pointers as when to think about it, how to ask about it, and where those patients should go for further management.
A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. And if you haven't signed up yet, we have a Patreon, patreon.com/curbsiders. Check it out. You can get ad-free episodes. You can get access to the CashLack vault with all of our graphics and show notes. You can get bonus episodes twice a month, a lot of other cool stuff. So patreon.com/curbsiders. And now, Paul, without further ado.
Are you waiting for me to say, so without further ado, let's get to it.
Tony, so great to have you join us and really excited to talk about this topic. But first, the audience wants to hear a hobby or interest that you have outside of medicine, if you have time for any hobbies or interests these days.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show. First of all, I really appreciate the opportunity to be a part of it. I'm going to be pretty stereotypical here and say golf. I do like to play. I'm not very good at it, if you were wondering. So golf for me is mostly just hitting the ball and then going and finding wherever it went, usually into the woods. But I do like being outside with friends and family. So that's a fun thing I do like to do.
Yeah, it's a good sport. Paul, do you play golf? I don't think I've ever asked you that before.
No, I tried early on before I actually went to medical school because I really wanted to be a yuppie. And like I was trying, I guess, to manifest wealth. I'm not really sure, but I was so bad at it that even the driving range things would just go 90 degrees the direction I was aiming. So I eventually had to give up.
Yeah. All right. Well, I always like tell people, Tony, if you have a podcast and a family, like my wife would kill me if I tried to play golf and have a podcast. Exactly. Like it takes too much time. Both take too much time. So
yeah, exactly. Now the secret is you have to get your wife, try to get your wife into the sport. That's my wife and I would play, before we had kids, we would play sometimes together.
Yeah. I think like it might be a late life thing. Yeah, if we ever come to golf, it'll be a late life thing for us.
Well, thankfully it's something you can do for a long time. So.
Mm-hmm. Everything but the golf is kind of the best. Like you're tolling around the golf carts, you get a beer, it's like a nice day outside, the birds are singing, like all that stuff is fantastic. It's just the actual sport itself that I struggle with a little bit.
Yeah, and you just can't stress about where the ball actually goes. It's all about just having fun. So I think that's the secret.
That's a good attitude. I think that's a good attitude for an amateur golfer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Paul, did you want to ask anything else?
Sure. Well, since we know you play golf, so plenty of failures there probably, but I think I'll ask the usual advice question actually. So do you have any advice or feedback that you either received or that you frequently give throughout your resident training, either one? It doesn't even necessarily have to be medicine specific.
Yeah, there's a couple of things. I think one is just writing everything down, which is something that what works well for me is just writing it down on my phone. So I always have it. So for instance, I do a new procedure or learn some new knowledge, just jotting in my phone. So next time that problem comes up, I can just pull out my phone and quickly review kind of what I did last time or what worked well, and then also add to it too. It's a living document, so you can quickly update it. And that just has really worked well for me throughout residency, and I continue to hopefully carry that on throughout my career. And it kind of makes you look like you really know what you're doing, even if you totally forgot. You just review it right before the new issue pops up, and it's like, you just did it the day before. So the other thing I'll say is just trying to get along with everyone, which sounds really simple, but in my time in residency, it seems like the people who really run into issues are not because they're a bad physician or bad surgeon. It's people who just can't seem to get along, with their coworkers or whoever it might be. So it sounds simple, but, it doesn't mean you have to be best friends with everyone, but really just trying to be nice and courteous and get along with everyone around you, seems to be really important.
Yeah. I think you can't go wrong with that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's that medical education. Like, I feel like, you've crossed the Rubicon of getting into medical school. So, like, you're smart and capable and that kind of stuff. But, like, it's the professionalism stuff that you cannot remediate. And I know that word is weaponized in certain circumstances. But on the other hand, like, the people who, exactly as you say, struggle the most are the ones who just don't do a good job of getting along with others, which is really 90% of the fight.
Yeah.
To swing back to the note-taking, what app are you using? Or is it just the Notepad app that comes with the iPhone? Or what are you doing?
That's it. Very simple. Okay. Yeah, just the note, and I have, like 300 notes now. And sometimes within notes, I have multiple notes on things. So I'll have like, intramedullary spinal cord tumors. I'll have notes on kind of each different type, on how we typically approach it in the OR, what's the typical post-op treatment, things to look for. And it just grows, and throughout my 7 years, it grows. And it's nice too, because if someone asks me, how do you do this type of procedure? Or how do you approach this problem? I can typically pull up my note on that and then just share it with people very simply. So there's probably a smarter way to do that than just the notes function on my phone, but that's what I've done, and so far it's worked out just fine.
I've shared on this podcast before, my geriatric cat is getting transdermal rifampicin for appetite stimulant, and you're supposed to alternate back and forth between ears. So the only thing I have from my phone is just a text to myself every night that says right ear, and then the next night left ear, and the next night right ear. So it's kind of like what you do. It's almost like intramedullary spinal cord tumors.
taking care of your cat sounds more complicated. I don't know what word you just said or what medication, but that's probably harder.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Paul, I think it's time to get to a case from Cashlack. And why don't you start us off?
Sure. We're going to talk about Ms. Jones. As the title of given away, this will be a neck pain case. But she is a 43-year-old woman. She's got a past history noteworthy for obesity, prediabetes, tobacco use, sleep apnea. She's presenting to your office with approximately 4 weeks of posterior neck pain. She doesn't have any specific antecedent event. There wasn't an injury that happened necessarily. It just kind of started quietly and got progressively worse. The pain is not super well characterized. Kind of sits at the base of her neck. Radius to both of her shoulders, which feel kind of tight. She does notice that the pain might get worse when she turns her head a little bit. And it's not been really relieved with acetaminophen, which she has tried. And she does note, after you ask, that it does seem better after a hot shower, but then starts hurting all over again. So we'll talk to your approach with sort of this type of neck pain and kind of how you start broadly. But before we even get there, I wonder if you couldn't just talk us through some of the anatomy, Tony. I've forgotten so much of it since medical school, and here it becomes sort of painfully relevant. So can you just talk us through what the possible pain generators might be here and what we should care about and what we can maybe possibly ignore?
Sure, absolutely. So I think first and foremost, the muscles in that area. I mean, that's most commonly what this is lots of different muscles going up to the head and neck, and those can get sore, they can be painful. And so that's just myofascial pain is kind of a broad category, and certainly the muscles can be painful. When you think about the spine itself, you know, there are a few things within the spine that can theoretically cause pain. One is you have the discs between the vertebrae. So in the neck, there are 7 different vertebrae and 8 nerves that come out from the spinal cord. And of course, the spinal cord's in the middle. And the discs are the shock absorbers between each of the bones. And then the back, you have the facet joints that connect them together in the back. And, you know, you have different areas where you can have nerves that get pinched. You can have the spinal cord that gets pinched in the middle, or you can have the nerves that get pinched as they come off the sides, and they basically come off between each of those bones typically. And so the cervical nerves are named according to the bone below them, which is different than the lumbar spine. It flips, and that's because there are 8 nerves in the cervical spine and 7 bones. So therefore, the C8 nerve lives between the C7 and the T1 bone, which sounds annoying, but to, you know, keep all that straight. But it's actually important, because when you start to figure out, you know, what type of pain a patient has in the clinic, it's important to line up your imaging findings with the symptoms that the patients have. So it's important to be like, okay, they have pain here, they have tightness here in the foramen at this level in the MRI. Does that line up? Yes or no? And if things start to really line up, then potentially you can figure out what the pain generator is. So classically, pinching of the spinal cord doesn't really cause pain. It causes dysfunction, which we're going to talk about later. Pinching of the nerves as they exit the spine through the foramen can cause radiculopathy, which is most commonly pain going down the arms from the neck. And then some other theoretical pain generators, which is tough to sort out, are the joints in the back, the facets. They can get arthritic and painful. And also the discs, as the shock absorbers, as they wear out, those can get arthritic and painful as well. But truthfully, it's pretty tough to sort out, you know, which, if a disc is causing pain or a joint is causing pain. I think that is pretty tough to sort out.
Yeah. What struck me there was when you said pinching of the cord causes more dysfunction than pain, and pinching of like the nerve root as it's exiting causes more pain. I know we're going to talk later about myelopathy, but that's one of those ones that I have just sort of like a vague notion of. Paul and I were talking about that beforehand, and but one that's more scary after, you know, reading about that compared to radiculopathy, which
seems bad.
Yeah, we see, absolutely. I think we see a lot of neck pain in primary care. You know, may or may not have radicular symptoms with it, but the either neck pain with or without radicular symptoms is something that comes up pretty often. So happy to have you talking us through this topic, and that's a great framework there. Thinking about the anatomy. So Paul, where are we going next with this conversation?
So actually, I mean, Matt, you mentioned framework. Tony, I wonder if, you know, you see a patient on your schedule, it says neck pain, as your schedule looks like mine at least. So I'm wondering, do you have an initial sort of broad framework, ways that you break this down? Like, do you think about it in terms of radicular or non-radicular? Is it acute or subacute? Like, do you do timeline, the type of pain, anatomic? Like, how do you start to think about neck pain even before you get into the patient's history?
Absolutely. Well, I think trying to sort out, there are kind of 3 main categories that the neck pain patient falls into. It's either someone who has neck pain, which is kind of muscular pain. And I see these patients in clinic too, because oftentimes, you know, a patient has neck pain, and if they get an MRI, anyone over 30 has some finding on an MRI of the spine, right? And so then they end up potentially getting a surgical referral, but maybe they don't have any radiculopathy or myelopathy. They just have neck pain. So I still definitely see those patients in a specialty clinic. And so trying to figure out, do they fall into that neck pain category, which is typically non-operative. There are special cases where that could be operative. One would be if they had a pathologic fracture secondary to cancer, or of course, if they had an infection, an osteomyelitis type picture, or another special one that sometimes we see is if they have really bad spine deformity. These are typically people who, you know, can't look up their head. They have a drop head deformity. And those are of very small minority. Most people just kind of have this run-of-the-mill neck pain that is a lot of times difficult to point to any particular pain generator. So that's kind of one bucket. I'm trying to figure out if they fall into that. Another one is radiculopathy, which is your patient with arm pain. And then the third one is myelopathy, which is the patient who's having dysfunction of their hands, clumsiness, and difficulty walking. And so, you know, whichever of those 3 categories someone falls into, treatment is going to be very different. for each of those patients.
This podcast is brought to you by Freed. Freed is an AI scribe that listens, transcribes, and writes medical documentation for you. Gabby, a family medicine physician, and Irez, a computer engineer, came up with Freed, a solution that could help alleviate the daily burden of overworked clinicians everywhere. And for Irez, selfishly, it would mean that he could spend more time with Gabby, who is spending nights, weekends, and holidays updating medical documentation. Freed turns clinicians' daily workflow into accurate documentation instantly. There's no training time, no onboarding, and no extra mental burden. All of the magic happens in just a few clicks, so clinicians can spend less energy on charting and more time on doing what they do best. Today, more than 4,000 clinicians and their spouses have fallen in love with Freed. Freed is an AI scribe that does your medical documentation for you. Charting is critical and necessary, but it steals your focus away from your patients, eats away your time with your family, and keeps you up at night. The burden of always having another chart to complete drains every clinician. Freed is an AI scribe that makes charting go away. It does your soap notes for you. Freed listens, prepares your notes, and writes patients' instructions. Charting is done before your patient walks out of the room. Freed learns your style over time, just like a human scribe, and it will never quit on you. Freed is loved by over 4,000 clinicians from every specialty. It is HIPAA compliant, takes 30 seconds to learn, and costs only $99 per month. And you can try Freed for free right now by going to freed.ai. And listeners of Curbsiders can use code CURB50 for $50 off their first month.
To dig in a little bit to the, I'm sure there's an exam and a history that you're doing to go through your differential there, but maybe start with myelopathy. Like what you said, the clumsiness and difficulty walking. Patients might not always just come in and like, maybe they'll say, I don't feel like I'm walking that well, but the clumsiness of the hands, like, how do you ask about that? Or what else do you ask about if you're worried for myelopathy?
Yeah, that's a great point. And a lot of times actually we'll see patients in our clinic for a lumbar spine issue for leg pain, but mm-hmm. then as part of that exam and part of ask, you find out that actually they've had difficulty walking. And then, you know, when you do the exam, you find they have some signs of myelopathy. And so the things that I would ask about for clumsiness of the hands, a classic one is buttoning your shirt. Do you have, difficult time buttoning your shirt? I think, you know, these days asking people if they're having a tough time working their phone is another thing you can ask them. Or you have a difficult time writing, feeding yourself. So these are all things that can be subtle, but in early myelopathy, I think it's important to pick up on those. And then walking as well, as you're walking a little worse, maybe, you know, you used to be able to go up and down the stairs, no problem. Now there has to be a handrail there that you're using, can be something that's subtle. And so asking those particular history points is important. And then from an exam perspective, every single patient I see in clinic, I make sure to do three things. And that's check their strength, check for reflexes and pathologic signs like Hoffman signs and Babinski, and then get them up and walk them in the clinic. And I usually tell people, I don't have a long runway here because I'm in a, you know, an office room, but, you know, let's do our best. Sometimes I suppose you can get people out in the hall if you really, really want to, but usually just even taking a few steps in the office, you can get an idea how the patient's walking. So so those are some things that I do to try to figure out whether this patient may have myelopathy or not.
So Babinski, at least I remember that's the one where you kind of rub the bottom of the foot and see if the big toe goes up or if the toes splay. What's the Hoffman's? Can you remind us about Hoffman's?
Yeah, Hoffman's is one, and that one's really easy to do in clinic because you don't have to make the patient take off their shoes or their socks or anything like that. So Hoffman's is basically where you just take the middle finger and you just flick it like this. For those who are on the video can see that. And typical response, a normal response will just be nothing like my hand is doing right now. But if you flick that nail on the middle finger and the thumb comes in, or a lot of times it's all the fingers will kind of flex in like this. And if they all, you know, involuntarily are flexing in, particularly the thumb is really the main thing that you're looking at, that would be a positive Hoffman sign, which would be an upper motor neuron sign, a sign that potentially the patient has some dysfunction within the spinal cord itself.
Yeah, I have to admit, I'm not doing that one, but it sounds like I could. I think I will now.
You can achieve it, Matt. I've done it. And whenever it's positive, it gives me the screaming memes. So I do, So the impetus behind this episode is to not miss myelopathy. So I do Hoffman probably more than a lot of folks. And it's every so often, you get the positive when you're like,
it's an easy one to do. You don't need a reflex hammer. Again, you don't need to make the patient take their shoes off. So it's just really quick. You can just grab their hand and just flick their nail a few times. And most people, thankfully, you won't see anything. But when you do, mm-hmm. it's profound. And it's and that is a pretty clear indicator that something's going on that shouldn't be.
Yeah.
And with the gait, since we're jumping ahead to the examination anyway, maybe we'll dig in a little bit more to it. Do you do tandem walk? So like the sort of heel toe, or like what kind of things are you put, what paces do you put the patients through to evaluate for upper motor neuron stuff?
Yeah, I think just having them walk normally is one thing if you're really worried about, because for even moderate myelopathy, sometimes patients will have a difficult time walking without a gait aid, you know, without a walker or something like that. In severe myelopathy, they're showing up in a wheelchair, unfortunately. So, you know, I don't necessarily think you need to make them do a really complicated, tandem walk. A lot of elderly patients probably can't do that anyhow. So, yeah. You know, I think for me, I'm typically just having them kind of get up and walk normally. You can typically tell if they pop out of the chair, walk across your office really quickly, then you're like, okay, the walking seems to be okay. Where you get everyone up and walking, even older people, you can start to pick up on, okay, this person is maybe not walking quite as well as I would expect. And then you kind of look at the family and they're like, yep, that's what it's been like for the last year. You're like, okay, well, that's the information I'm looking for. The family can really give you a lot of clues, even if the patient's like, I'm fine. And you're like, mm-hmm. look at their, you know, family that they bring with or their friend. And it's like, actually, you've been kind of unsteady lately on your feet. And so that can be a good clue.
And anything about the hands that you look for, like the interosseous muscle wasting, is that like a really late finding for this?
Yeah, typically interosseous wasting, I think it would be more lower motor neuron finding. Typically, you don't see that as much in myelopathy, at least that's not something that I'm as aware of.
Okay.
But certainly patients can have numbness in their hands as well. Hand dysfunction can certainly be another thing that you can find on exam. Okay. Yep.
So with myelopathy, we talked about that's like basically the cord itself is being pinched more centrally. And we said to look out for, you know, are they having clumsiness of their hands? Are they having the difficulty walking? We just talked about the exam. So maybe we go back to radiculopathy and how do you...
Why don't we get back to Ms. Jones first before we give her something catastrophic? Maybe we can just talk about what you do for someone who's just having neck pain before they're going to fall over.
Sure.
So can you sort of talk us through fundamental examinations, then we can sort of walk her and make worse and worse things happen to our patients.
Yeah, fair enough. So the typical neck pain patient, you know, I think one really reassuring finding on exam is if they have pain to palpation, you know, if they're like, oh, my neck really hurts, and you push on their neck and the muscles and they're like, ow. And I'm like, is that your pain that you're having? And they say, yes, probably muscle pain, you know, because you're not pushing on the spine when you're just kind of palpating like that. So that can be really reassuring. And then I think in the absence of any of those red flags, like new profound major weakness, certainly, you know, no arm pain, you know, no difficulty walking, no, all the things we just talked about, no cancer history, you're not worried about infection, then you kind of get down to a diagnosis of exclusion, which is they kind of have neck pain that unfortunately a lot of us have. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you know, there's a lot of different treatments out there. And I really tell patients, what may work for you is hard for me to predict. So you just kind of keep trying things till you find something that works. You know, I'm not aware of any great evidence for one particular thing. I think exercise is maybe something that we have the best evidence for helping with neck pain. But unfortunately, a lot of people get it. The good news is for a lot of people, it's self-limited. I think it will improve, with time. But certainly you can try exercise, more organized therapy, physical therapy. And the idea behind that is I explain to patients, you're just getting the muscles stronger so they hurt less. And that seems to make sense. Other thing like NSAIDs, of course, topical or oral, of course, always watching for that kidney function, which you guys know about that better than I do, but I try to not make that mistake either. You know, putting someone with chronic kidney disease on Toradol is always bad. And, you know, muscle relaxers, another thing you can try. I don't know what you guys like to use, but I think methocarbamol is one that's kind of my go-to because it seems to be less sedating than some of the other options like cyclobenzaprine and diazepam. I don't know if you guys have any others that typically work well for you.
Paul's America's primary care, so I'd be curious to see if he has a favorite.
Yeah, because I'm a coward, I like cyclobenzaprine. It just seems the one that is the least scary to me. I don't tend to fuss with the benzodiazepines, even though I think there might be a little bit of evidence, but it's cyclobenzaprine is the one I tend to reach for the most because it just seems to be the cleanest that I work with. I don't know, Matt, what do you do?
Well, I mean, because of this dating concern, I do usually tell people to take it at bedtime, certainly
for sure.
The first time they take it. But I think for a lot of my patients, if sleep is disrupted, I think that's a good one. But methylcarbamol is one I actually, because it's a couple times a day and you can titrate the dose, that's one. And a lot of patients have not tried it before, so it's something that I will sometimes use and patients haven't heard of it. So sometimes that, I feel like, gives you a little bit of buy-in, Paul. If they haven't heard of it, they're like, okay, it's not the same that people have given me in the past.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially this patient in particular is kind of right on the cusp of acute still, or maybe like drifting into subacute. And in those cases, I'm more likely to use a muscle relaxant than I would if someone had a similar story and have been having this for months and months and months. And I might be a little bit less excited about muscle relaxants. That's just extrapolating from like low back pain stuff.
Yeah. There are other things patients can try, like acupuncture, massage therapy, medial branch blocks. So we'll sometimes refer these patients to our pain medicine colleagues who can do a number of different injections, trigger point injections, set injections, where you inject in the joints in the back. Mm-hmm. One thing that'll sometimes work well for patients is medial branch blocks and then radio frequency ablation. And I explain that to patients like there are these little nerves around the joints in the back of the neck and their only job in life is to give you pain. And so what we do is you can numb up those nerves and that's step one. And if that works well, then they can go in and this is percutaneous with a little tiny heater and do radio frequency ablation and burn those nerves. And potentially that would provide some relief. Sometimes they need to repeat that, but that's another thing that, if a patient is really struggling, this isn't your acute neck pain patient, of course, like Mrs. Jones, but someone who has maybe really struggling with it for a long time and they've kind of tried everything and they're at their wit's end, then maybe that would be someone you may refer to one of these pain providers who could try some of these more advanced techniques.
I wanted to ask about Ms. Jones. You mentioned you're just kind of run-of-the-mill, non-specific neck pain is not necessarily going to the arms and maybe you press on an area and it's reassuring if they have pain over the muscles. But with her, she's having this posterior neck pain, but it's also going to both shoulders. So do you consider that radiculopathy or can that just kind of spread from someone with non-specific neck pain? Can it spread that far as the shoulders?
Yeah, if it's both sides, that really decreases my suspicion for that. Because typically if a patient has radiculopathy, foraminal stenosis is typically one side or the other. It'd be pretty rare to be same level, both sides, unless it's something more unusual, like a tumor or something like that. But, both sides is making me less suspicious for that. It certainly can happen. C5 radiculopathy is typically up in the shoulder. 4 can be a little bit higher up on the neck. So. Mm-hmm. But it's an unusual level as well to have foraminal stenosis. The most common levels are kind of in the middle of the neck. Those are the levels that move the most and seem to just be the ones that wear out the most, which would be C4, 5, 5, 6, 6, 7. Those are the levels that seem to wear out most commonly. Whereas to get a C4 radiculopathy, which would be higher up on the neck, would be 3, 4 level, which is just, it's less common. Certainly it can happen. You kind of see everything, not every patient follows the textbook perfectly. So that's why sometimes it's a little bit of a puzzle to figure out where the pain is coming from, but typically not.
Okay. It took me a second there because I remember you told us that the cervical nerves are named by the vertebrae, that below it. So, the C4 nerve is above the C4 vertebrae. Got it.
Exactly. Between 3 and 4. Yep. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're practically a neurosurgeon.
Yeah.
Repetition for the audience, Paul. I think about the audience member following along. I want to make sure they're remembering these pearls that he's giving us here. So this is great. Okay. We talked about a whole bunch of options. I saw that, and Paul, I don't know if when you refer to physical therapy, Tony, I want to hear what you do, but I'm always like, when the person comes in and they've had pain for like a week or two, and they're still like pretty acute, like really in a lot of discomfort, you're like, what do I do for them? Of course, you can give them some medications like we talked about. But it's like, when do you refer them for more of like a movement-based physical therapy or something like that? Tony, when should we refer?
Oh, it's a good question. I think everyone's a little bit different. Some people maybe just want to wait. Some people really want to get out and try some therapy right away. I'm not aware of any specific guidelines that say you need to wait X number of days. I know neck pain is pretty variable. I think a lot of people get neck pain and maybe it's gone after a few days, maybe is some in a select number of patients, it's more chronic. You know, I know the numbers for like cervical radiculopathy, for instance, about 90% of those patients get better, significantly better in 6 to 12 weeks. Neck pain, I can imagine it may be similar. So I think just talking with a patient, this has only been a week or two. Do you want to try some therapy? And if they really have a strong appetite for it, then maybe that's something that would be good if they've had good luck with doing physical therapy in the past. But yeah, I can't give you a specific guideline on that, at least nothing that I'm aware of.
Yeah, I think that the degree of enthusiasm for physical therapy is proportionate to how frustrated they are with their pain. So like it usually, like in the early phases, I think they're willing to kind of wait it out, try some medications, but the longer it persists, there seems to be a little bit more enthusiasm for physical therapy. And I think that's also probably a fairly reasonable approach too.
Yeah.
But you mentioned the radicular pain more than likely going away, and we'll get to that. But what about this mechanical or axial neck pain? What if we just opt to do nothing? How good are the odds for this patient that it might just get better on its own with us just distracting them?
Yeah, I think the vast majority of mechanical neck pain patients are going to get better with time. Maybe it'll recur, maybe not. But I think that's kind of the take home point, I think. I don't have an exact number for you as far as X number of patients, you know, but I think that we can say, I think reassurance is a good first step for these patients.
I do want to ask, when might you image this patient? My sense is that this is not in the absence of radicular symptoms, and especially in the relatively acute phases, you know, without anything worrisome on examination, there's probably not a role, except for maybe a therapeutic x-ray, just to reassure the patient that, you know, their head's not going to fall off. But are there any circumstances where you might image, or when would you consider imaging for someone with this type of mechanical neck pain?
Yeah, I think if you don't have any radiculopathy, no evidence of myelopathy, you know, someone to consider imaging would be someone with like a cancer history and new neck pain. That would be someone who I would be concerned about and want to image. Again, if there's some infection concern, you know, certainly if there's a trauma history, that would be someone as well. Although typically I think those patients are probably coming to the ER, but you know, I suppose if it's a minor trauma, sometimes maybe they would, present in a more delayed manner to a primary care office as well. So, those would be people who I'd be like, well, maybe we should check for, you know, do some more advanced imaging. But I think the vast majority of patients, without any of those kind of red flags, I think that just reassurance and probably imaging would be pretty low yield.
Well, while we're on the subject of imaging, before we move on to the next case, I know Matt's champing at the bit, but I do, in terms of the terminology that's used sometimes in just these plain films, and I just wanted to make sure that we talked about this just because I struggle with this kind of stuff. Like there's spondylosis and spondylolisthesis and spondylolysis, and I don't know which of those I should be worried about or what they mean, frankly, much of the time. So could you just sort of outline the terms we might commonly come across just so that we know what we should panic about and what is just sort of an incidental finding?
Yeah, of course.
Or if that's even possible.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Yeah, so they all sound similar, right? So who came up with these names? So spondylosis, it just refers to kind of the general wear and tear that you get on the spine that frankly, you know, everyone over the age of 30 has. It's just degenerative arthritis changes. And, you know, I'll sometimes tell patients in the clinic, you know, that's what happens because the woolly mammoth doesn't take us out in our 30s anymore, which sometimes that joke hits and sometimes people just look at me like I'm crazy. But, you know, I still like that one. But it's really true. You know, you just spend enough time on the planet, you're going to have degenerative wear and tear changes on your spine, and that's termed spondylosis. Spondylolisthesis is when you have a slippage of one of the bones on top of the other. So you have anterolisthesis, which is when the bone is slipped forward, and retrolisthesis, which is when the bone is slipped backwards, and that's named the top vertebra relative to the bottom one. More common in the lumbar spine. And then spondylolysis is a special term that's typically refers to lumbar spine, which is pars fractures, typically develop at L5. And that's where you get a fracture through the pars. And then that, because the pars is disconnected from the bone, the front of the bone starts to slide forward and can lead to spondylolisthesis. So it's confusing because patients can have multiple things that all sound very similar. So I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Yeah, it does.
Okay, great.
That is helpful. Can I ask something that just occurred to me now? Sorry to just throw this at you, but it's another finding that I see that comes up fairly often, and I would love to hear your take on whether or not this is impactful or what to do with this. Is this DISH or the diffuse idiopathic skeletal hyperosteosis? Like, I feel like that's a finding that pops up on imaging. I'm like, oh, that sounds like a lot of words. Like, I don't know if it's like actually something to attribute their pain to or not. Is that something that can cause sort of neck or low back pain while we have you here as our expert?
Yeah. So DISH is something that we don't exactly know why patients get it. Typically, they're older, sicker patients, an inflammatory response. Typically, it's common in diabetics. And so we think it may be this low-grade inflammatory response. Basically, the bones start to fuse together. And the ligaments that connect the spine, they start to become brittle and hard, and eventually they fuse together. That doesn't cause pain per se, but what it does do is it does fuse the bones into kind of, instead of being multiple individual bones, it becomes one long tube of bone, basically similar to like a femur or, an extremity bone. And so it doesn't cause pain. When that really becomes a problem for us in spine surgery is when patients have even minor falls can cause that bone to break. So now instead of all these individual bones connected by these strong ligaments, it's kind of a glass tube, and that glass tube can crack and the spinal cord lives inside that glass tube. So that can be, those can be really unstable fractures, and they can be missed sometimes because the tube cracks. And then when you get imaging, the cracks reoppose, so it's hard to see. So that's more commonly we're dealing with DISH patients in the trauma setting. Typically it's an older patient who's, sick, not well, falls, minor trauma that develops a fracture. But typically just having DISH by itself typically does not cause back pain.
Yeah, that sounds like a terrifying description of how what happens to a spine.
Sorry I asked.
Yeah. I hope I don't get that, Paul.
No, yeah. Yeah.
I hope I don't get that.
I don't feel better, but I'm glad that I asked, so thank you for that.
Okay. This is good. So I feel like, spondylosis, that's the general wear and tear. Listhesis is the slipping of the bone forward or backward. Lysis is the pars fracture that can then lead to a bone being able to slip forward or backward. Exactly. And then DISH is where your spine turns into a glass tube, and then you just have to hope you don't fall.
Yeah, don't fall.
You have unstable neck fractures.
Don't fall. Don't get the glass tube. Don't get either one.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, Paul. What's next?
So let's move on to Ms. Jones's twin sister, who is conveniently named Ms. Jones. And you can tell when we get to at this stage of my career, I just get tired of coming up with names. But so Ms. Jones comes into our office. She's reporting neck pain, not surprisingly. Ms. Jones also has a history of obesity, tobacco use, prediabetes, and sleep apnea. In this Ms. Jones's case, her neck pain has been ongoing for about 3 months. It is right-sided specifically and radiates down her right arm to her two middle fingers. She is right-hand dominant because we actually remember to ask despite being internists. She says the arm feels funny sometimes, and she does have some subjective weakness on the right-hand side. And she describes the pain as shock-like and burning, and it's not relieved by acetaminophen because very little is. And she does note that when she's lying in bed, and this is an amazing historical thing that she volunteers, she reports that the pain might feel better when her arm is kind of tucked above her head. It just seems, things seem to feel better in general. So Ms. Jones, we're leading the witness a little bit, is having symptoms that are probably consistent with cervical radiculopathy. This all sounds fairly classic. So can you talk us through underlying pathophys about what typical cervical radiculopathy looks like, what's happening there, and what's going on with the nerves and stuff that are making her feel this way?
Yeah. So cervical, as you painted a kind of very classic picture of this, and sometimes patients will present with exactly the story, and it makes it very easy on us where we can know what the pain generator is. But basically, the nerves, as they exit the spinal cord, come out the side between the bones, and sometimes those nerves get pinched, whether that's due to disc herniation or as we get older, you can get some degenerative changes, some arthritis can build up there, some of the ligaments can get hypertrophied, and they can pinch the nerves. And exactly why does that cause pain? No one really knows 100%. Maybe it's an inflammatory response, but it does. That's one thing we do know is that, whatever the underlying pathophysiology is, it can cause pain for patients. And when those nerves get pinched, they classically have, a pattern. Each nerve has a pattern of pain that can happen. And so I always just kind of think about C4, less common, but typically kind of up on the neck. 5 is more deltoid in the shoulder region. A C6 radiculopathy, which again would come out between the C5 and the C6 bone, just to review that. C6 is six shooter, so typically the thumb and index finger. C7 is middle finger. C8 would typically go into the pinky finger, and then T1 is kind of the inside of the elbow as far as pain. And that doesn't always line up. Not every patient reads the textbook perfectly. But that typically gets you in the ballpark. And then there are specific muscles that can get weak as a result of that. C5 is typically deltoid weakness. C6 can cause biceps weakness and also wrist extension. C7 is more triceps extension. 8 is more kind of grip strength, finger flexion. And then T1, finger abduction, kind of spreading the fingers out. And so those are the typical things that I'm, you know, when a patient tells me they have kind of neck pain, you know, electrical burning pain extending down into the arm, I'm kind of figuring out what's the pattern of pain and kind of trying to start to put the puzzle together a little bit.
This episode is brought to you by Grammarly. There are many elements to this job, but a key feature of all of them is communication. And that can be when I'm talking to patients, that can be when I'm talking to learners, that can be when I'm podcasting or recording and putting together a script for an episode. And if you've heard me talk, you kind of get a sense of how I write. And so I often sound a little bit ambivalent, equivocal, one might say, a little bit unsure of myself. But with Grammarly as an AI writing partner, I'm able to communicate more effectively and efficiently so I can make a bigger impact in the work that I do. I have personally used Grammarly to actually work on a speech that I gave at the end of the year. And as I mentioned, one of the things I really like are the tone suggestions. So it actually, I can go through and very quickly restructure sentences so that they sound more effective and more confident, which is something that I sometimes struggle with, as you can tell when I'm putting together sentences. And I'm not the only one that finds Grammarly helpful. About 96% of Grammarly users report that Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing. It works across 500,000 apps and websites, and that feels like a lot. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions, and their tone suggestions, as I mentioned, help you navigate even the most difficult work conversations. If this sounds appealing to you, and it should, try making a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Sign up and download for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
So what's the exam going to look like for a patient like Ms. Jones coming in with this complaint, just to confirm your suspicion that this is radiculopathy?
Yeah, so it's definitely asking her really pointed questions about where does the pain go. She did provide us a little bit of history there with raising the shoulder up, you know, the shoulder abduction sign. That's admittedly not something I do routinely in clinic, but, you know, you offered that in your vignette. That's kind of a classic thing. And the idea behind that is when you raise the shoulder up, the nerve is just a string of spaghetti. And when you raise it up, it takes tension off the nerve and decreases the distance it has to travel. So that may relieve pain, probably not sensitive, but maybe specific. And, you know, other things you hear about people talking about is doing a Sperling sign, which is basically if your right side hurts, you know, you bend the neck and turn to that right side and then you push down in their head. And if they have pain that goes down the arm, then that's a positive sign. Again, I don't know, that may hurt your reviewer ratings if you start doing that to everybody in clinic. Yeah.
I feel like that can't be a sensitive sign. Yeah. Just like, no, it just can't be sensitive.
I don't think so. Oh yeah. I don't think it is. So again, it's not one that I typically do, but it's one that you'll hear about. But again, I really do the same thing for every patient. I check their strength. And again, I'm checking each of those groups. So as I'm checking the strength, I'm thinking about this is the C5 nerve, this is C6, this is C7. And so I check all those muscles, and then I'm doing the reflexes, which again, even though she's presenting with radiculopathy, she could still have myelopathy. It's just not the reason they're there. You know, typically patients go seek care because of pain. They typically slow onset, walking issues, working the hands. Not as common for people to seek care, but if their arm really hurts, they want something done about it. So sometimes that's why they'll present, even though the myelopathy is maybe the bigger issue that needs to be addressed. So making sure to get all the reflexes that we've talked about, before, you know, so I always just kind of, I have a reflex hammer I bring with me to clinic. That's, the one tool I bring in.
So for the physical examination, yeah. Dorks, Tony, what type of reflex hammer are we using here?
Yeah, there's actually a reflex hammer that, one of our staff, gave to me. He gives to everyone, not just me, after they complete. After you complete his rotation. So, you know, we have a mentorship model at Mayo where you're paired up with one staff or two or sometimes three for 2 or 3 months at a time. And after you finish his rotation, he gives everyone a reflex hammer. It's a really nice, fancy wood hammer that's has your name engraved on it. So that's the one that I use. I can't remember the exact company, but
does it have the triangle at the top or is it like the circle top? What is it?
It has little rubber ends on it, so it's wooden, and then it has these little black rubber pieces on either end. So
okay.
Seems to get the job done. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the one you bring. Check the biceps, which is going to be C5 theoretically with radiculopathy, although we don't typically see this, is typically your reflexes can be diminished with a lower motor neuron sign. So if you have a C5 or C6 radiculopathy, you could potentially have diminished biceps and brachioradialis reflexes. C7 would be triceps classically. And then even if they're there for a neck complaint, I would check the reflexes in the lower extremities as well, looking for myelopathy. Patellar and Achilles, really easy to quickly tap those out and check that as well. Check the Hoffman's and everybody. Babinski, if I'm really worried about it, but the honest answer is I don't make every single person take their socks and shoes off, but if I'm worried about it, then I'll make them do that or ask them to do that, and then get them up and walk as well, every patient, just because that can be a really quick way to get a lot of good information. So I do the same thing for this radiculopathy patient. And most radiculopathy patients just have pain. They don't have a real profound weakness or any other finding on exam, but I think it's just good to do, and it doesn't take that much time to hit the high points.
Matt, what are you using to check reflexes?
I have like just a heavy, like a triangle shaped hammer. I should get one of the better, like really heavy ones that the neurologists carry around.
Okay.
What are you?
Yeah,
I use
my stethoscope still.
I'll have to
upgrade after this.
I don't like using the stethoscope. It doesn't, like, if I'm really worried, I like to have a good reflex hammer to check reflexes. Yeah. You said radiculopathy, they might tend to have diminished reflexes versus myelopathy. You would expect more brisk reflexes because it's upper motor neuron signs.
Exactly.
For myelopathy and more lower motor neuron with radiculopathy.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. So diminished for lower motor neuron radiculopathy. And then if they're hyperreflexic, then that could be indicative of myelopathy. Sometimes patients have both. We don't need to get into that today, but that can make it, you know, a little
extra. That's when they're coming
confusing.
To see you.
Yeah.
I'm not going to figure that one out, Tony. I'm just not.
No, I just said something just bubbled up in my brain. I think it's the cervical distraction sign. Is that a thing too? I feel like I read in one of the papers about like literally grabbing the patient's head and just yanking up and seeing if it makes things feel better, which makes anatomic sense to me, but also seems pointless and kind of cruel. Is that, did I just completely make that up? That might just be a fever dream I had at some point.
Yeah, it could be. Again, not something I routinely do in clinic.
You're trying to pop their head off like they're a dandelion, Paul?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, Google
just straight
dizzle,
like it's near chiropractic.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? If it works for you, then keep doing it.
Listen, I'm not endorsing it.
Okay. So we mentioned for the first case that probably people with just nonspecific neck pain without red flags don't need imaging. I think the radiculopathy cases are always, it always feels a little more tricky. Who needs imaging, who doesn't? Especially you're talking about there could be subtle weakness. Mostly people are presenting with pain or maybe some sensory symptoms. So how do you approach that for someone with like Mrs. Jones's twin sister with the radiculopathy?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the vast majority of patients with radiculopathy, you know, we have data showing about 90% of patients after 6 to 12 weeks, their radiculopathy will be gone or significantly better. So I think if it's really early, and, you know, it's been a couple of weeks, I think reassurance is the main thing. I don't think I would rush to get a lot of imaging at that point. If it's been longer than that amount of time and they've tried some of these other things, they've tried some physical therapy or you've started them on gabapentin or something like that, and, you know, they're still really struggling or maybe the pain is getting worse, well, maybe at that point it's time to start to get some advanced imaging, maybe an MRI. And 6 weeks is kind of that minimum time, I think, to allow that to play out. An exception to that would be profound weakness or some other really, you know, something really serious is going on. That would be uncommon. But by profound weakness, I mean, you know, someone just can't lift their arm up or, you know, their hand is just, you know, they can barely squeeze their hand together or something like that. That would be, you know, concerning and would prompt, I think, more advanced imaging.
Probably stat as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. More urgently. But again, in the absence of any, you know, and typically profound weakness, I would tell people would be like a 3 out of 5 or like less than 3 out of 5 weakness. It's not, oh yeah, it started a week ago. Your arm feels a little weak. I don't think that would be someone who I would go and get an MRI and right away. Even if they're a little weak, I think I would still just say, let's just give it time. Most of these will resolve and not rush right into getting an MRI.
I think I often see and maybe I'm mistaken about this, but just to even get an MRI kind of blessed by the insurance companies, you sort of need plain film imaging, which I think we sometimes also order just kind of initially just to see what there is to see, like if there's, you know, any narrowing or anything that might be contributing to radiculopathy. So I my question to you is, if we are to do that, I guess what views are especially helpful or what should we order? I feel like that's always, as internists, we just order the one choice that has the most options, which maybe not necessarily be the best choice. So what imaging of the, what plain films of the cervical spine might be helpful here, even though obviously MRI would be more useful for radiculopathy probably.
Yeah, plain films are tough for just radiculopathy because, of course, it's tough to see foramenal stenosis or really get a good look at the nerves. You need an MRI for that. So, you know, MRI without contrast, don't need contrast unless it's a tumor or an infection case, would be kind of the go-to. You know, of course, if we're doing surgical planning or thinking about what we want to do there, x-rays are very important for me then. AP and lateral, sometimes I'll get flex X films as well, flexion extension x-rays, to see if some of those bones are shifting on top of the other, the spondylolisthesis that we talked about, and sometimes CT as well, but for surgical planning for certain cases. But I think the main thing, if it's radiculopathy and it's been a long enough period of time and a patient has kind of tried some things and it's not getting better or it's getting worse, ultimately, if they're going for a surgical opinion, I think an MRI is kind of necessary, unfortunately.
Yeah, so very similar to back pain, Paul, when we talked about that. Just sounds,
yeah.
When might you consider an EMG? I figure sometimes there's some temptation just to actually make sure that you know the diagnosis. Is there a role for that ever? Or is that a fairly niche thing or something like a nerve conduction study?
Yeah, EMG can be very helpful. I think the honest answer for cervical radiculopathy, you know, this was, and this is also in the guidelines in 2017, a bunch of experts came out in Global Spine Journal. EMG really don't have great evidence to support its use or not support its use when looking at cervical radiculopathy. The honest answer is patients can have cervical radiculopathy and the EMG doesn't show it. You know, and so it's not a great rule out or rule in test. You know, it's not like
perfect.
If the EMG, yeah, exactly. So it's really not that helpful if it's just cervical radiculopathy. When I do find it helpful is if we're trying to figure out if something else is going on. Do they have maybe a carpal tunnel? You know, is there an ulnar neuropathy? Is there some type of peripheral neuropathy? Those cases, it's very helpful because EMG is very reliable picking out carpal tunnel syndrome and ulnar neuropathy, things like that. Mm. You know, of course, if you're trying to rule out some less common things as well, like ALS and, you know, uncommon things. If things just aren't adding up, then I think EMG may be another test that can maybe give you some additional information. But if this is someone who you're trying to figure out cervical radiculopathy versus not, EMG is not the most helpful test.
I've had a number of patients recently complain to me about EMG nerve conduction studies.
Yeah.
If they've ever had one, they're like, I don't ever want another one of those. Like that was a terrible experience. And I don't know if that's just my sample, you know, of people, but it seems like it's not the most comfortable thing for patients. I've never had one done to me, but I don't know, Tony, is that something your patients complain about to you?
Yeah, no, for sure. It's, it's putting needles all over in the arm. You know, it's not a enjoyable thing. And you know, not only that, they put the needles in to test fibrillations and things. I'm not an EMG expert. I won't pretend I am. Our neurology colleagues do that. But administering little shocks, you know, it's shocking the patient too, to see, do the nerves conduct and work? And so, yeah, I can imagine it's not comfortable. So it's not only is it an additional expense, but patients probably don't like it either. So it's something I think, you know, it's definitely not everyone would I get an EMG on. It's just if it's a weird case and I'm worried about peripheral neuropathy or, you know, there's just things aren't adding up and I need a little more information.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to discourage anyone from ordering one, more just giving the patient a heads up like, you know, this might be uncomfortable. I think it's necessary for these reasons. Just
absolutely.
I've learned that the hard way is my saying.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, give them the heads up that this is not going to be, just like getting an x-ray.
Okay, so for Ms. Jones, the twin, let's say we don't get any historical features that we find particularly alarming. This seems like bread and butter, standard issue cervical radiculopathy. It's been going on for a while now, I guess. Can we just sort of talk through what interventions are able? You said a lot of the times it just gets better, or at least will go away or get better on its own. But is there anything that we can do to hasten that process? You know, is it the usual sort of physical therapy? What other things can we consider for this particular case?
Yeah, so The things that make the most sense to me are the things that are going to treat nerve pain, which would be neuropathic medicines, such as gabapentin. Also, transfemoral epidural steroid injections is another thing that you can consider. You know, we have low quality evidence in that guideline that I mentioned that, you know, about 60 low quality data showing about 60% of patients can get some relief. You know, it's a relatively low risk procedure. Again, our pain colleagues do that, but that's something that can be both diagnostic and therapeutic, in that a lot of times patients get these MRIs and unfortunately it's not just one level that looks tight. They're kind of tight at multiple levels. And of course, we don't want to just treat the whole spine. You know, we can't do that. It's not, you know, for instance, if you have a, if your knee hurts, you know, you have one knee, you can go and treat that. You have all these levels in the spine. So, you know, we really want to do the smallest surgery we can for people that's going to provide them the most benefit. So sometimes a transforaminal epidural steroid injection can be diagnostic, and that if we go and we inject that 5-6 level on the right side and Ms. Jones says, wow, I felt amazing for like a week. My pain went away completely. That was, you know, a miracle. Can I have another one of those? I feel pretty confident that if we go and address that 5-6 level, that patient's going to do well. So, and it can also be therapeutic, of course, too, in that sometimes patients will go and get those injections and they'll be better forever. They'll just, that'll treat their pain, and then it just won't come back. You know, the inflammation or whatever was going on quiets down, and which is great. Again, like you'd mentioned, the vast majority of radiculopathy patients will just get better with time. So sometimes it's just doing these things to kind of limp them through that period till they get better. And then if they don't get better, that's when surgery starts to be on the table for discussion.
And I guess, yeah, that's sort of for you. I guess that it's just when these symptoms are refractory, it's sort of the standard issue stuff. Like, I guess it's, does every patient who does not get better, are they candidates for surgery? Or I guess, is there somebody who seems like an especially who might benefit the most from surgery? I guess I'm just trying to figure out who should I have sent to you quickly, yeah. And who should you be my Hilparion pass for?
Yeah, yeah. And I guess, you know, it's how fast you send people. Typically, you know, these aren't urgent issues, of course. Some people will say, you know, oh, my arm really hurts. I want to get in right away. I think it's just, let's just slow down. This is probably going to get it better on its own. And if it doesn't, minimum 6 weeks, I would say, before you even get any imaging, and then you get the referral, and that takes time. So typically they've had this for at least a couple months, you know, 2 to 3 months. So someone who I consider for surgery would be someone who's tried some of these non-operative measures. Maybe it was gabapentin, maybe physical therapy, maybe an injection or some combination. Hasn't worked. Maybe it's the same or getting worse. Would be someone who you'd start to be like, okay, we've kind of tried a lot of different things. And that's when you really have a conversation, you know, how much is this bothering you? Because this isn't like a life or limb function quality, you know, more the myelopathy patient. That's a totally different story. This is, you have arm pain. How much is this bothering you? If they say, nah, not really. Then I say, well, you know, maybe surgery isn't something that we want to pursue. If they say, you know, wow, this is, you know, I'm a person in my 40s. I have a manual labor job. I can't work. I can't provide for my family because my arm hurts so bad or it's weak. You know, I'm going to lose my job. Well, that's a pretty good reason to go ahead and you know, maybe and offer surgery. So the other one that, again, is less common is someone who has a really profound neurologic weakness or issue. And maybe if it's getting progressive, that would be someone who you could say, okay, let's go ahead and maybe consider surgery. But the more classic one is that person who's had the pain for a while. They've tried some things, it's not getting better, or it's getting worse, and it's really impacting their quality of life. And then you talk about surgical options.
Do you have a sense of the outcomes for patients like that? Like, I mean, it seems like you really sort of don't offer it unless it's super impactful to the patient. Is that because the outcomes aren't certain, or sort of how do people do after this type of surgery typically?
Yeah, so typically if you pick your patients really well, I think you know, for spine surgery in general, if you do a really good operation for the right patients, people can do very, very well. And these patients certainly fall into that category, you know, and we cherry pick our patients. There's no doubt about it, right? We're picking people who have classic symptoms, that the symptoms line up with the imaging, and they've tried all these other things and it hasn't worked. You know, those are the patients that, you know, you offer surgery to, and the outcomes are very good. You know, I typically tell people if everything lines up, typically 85-90% chance they're going to be very happy after surgery. Happy meaning their pain is gone or significantly better. And the exciting thing about that is that it typically is right away. You know, it's something that you know, you see them in the recovery room and they're like, yep, arm pain's gone. Thank you. So it's instantaneous, you know, typically, if you are able to successfully decompress that nerve and that was the pain generator, then it can be right away, which is pretty gratifying.
So Paul, on to the last case. I think we have one more left.
Yep, let's make her even worse. So it's Ms. Jones is in for a bad ride. So let's say that we take an even better history. So rather than just assuming this is bread and butter radiculopathy, we ask a little bit more questions. And she does indeed endorse some hand awkwardness. It's been harder for her to do things like tie her shoes or sort of the fine motor activities. Her hands go numb every so often. And she's, you think to ask about urinary hesitancy or urinary issues. And she's like, yeah, I actually do have that. And I've been feeling off balance when I walk, which she had been chalking up to old age and just kind of arthritis, but it has been progressive and noticeable to her and to her family. And you examine her. And you actually do a good examination. She has some weakness of her bilateral upper extremities. You note that her patellar reflexes are pretty brisk. So I think we're calling them 3+ and symmetric. She's got an extensor plantar reflex and her gait is fairly wide-based and wobbly. There's no chance of tandem gait. You try to sort of have her heel toe and she almost goes over. And so you abort immediately. So this exam history, I would think, would change things. So this, we're trying to paint a picture of cervical myelopathy. And I wonder if you could talk us through what that is. I feel like it's kind of a confusing term that I don't remember ever hearing in like a medical school or even really thinking about much during residency. So can you tell us what's happening here and how this classically presents?
Yeah. So myelopathy, now we're talking about the spinal cord itself, which is certainly much more serious. You know, radiculopathy, the nerve root, myelopathy, the spinal cord. So now the spinal cord is getting pinched. And when that happens classically in the cervical spine, and this is the most common cause of spinal cord dysfunction in the United States, is degenerative cervical myelopathy or DCM. Typically, it's an older patient, sometimes can be middle-aged people as well, but typically older patient who's had progressive onset of clumsiness of the hands, difficulty buttoning their shirt, again, working their phone, writing, feeding themselves, maybe some imbalance with walking. And the urinary retention can be a late finding, but in truth, that's a relatively uncommon thing for cervical myelopathy. And so it really requires a high index of suspicion, I think, because these are typically older patients and sometimes people just chalk it up to I'm getting older. But really, you know, it's really doing the exam can really help you figure out that this is more than just getting older, and also the time course as well. You know, there's getting older and then there's, wow, this has been getting worse over the last year or two. You know, this is maybe a little more than we would expect in someone who's in their 60s or 70s.
And as opposed to radiculopathy, where this kind of, we assume it's going to get better most of the time. So can you talk me through the natural history of myelopathy? It sounds like this is, at least according to my reading, some diagnosis that may often be missed early on. So what happens if we just sort of cheerfully ignore it? Is this patient going to get better, or what's their course going to look like?
Yeah, so typically the natural history of this is that patients are going to get worse. You know, it's kind of a slow progressive worsening. Sometimes patients will have stepwise decline, very rarely rapid decline. But usually in clinical practice, we see that this is typically something that's been going on for months to maybe a year or two. And it's just kind of this slow progressive decline. And unfortunately, there are no non-operative measures that we really have any evidence for to say that that can result in improvement. And it gets a little confusing because cervical stenosis is something that's a radiographic finding that we can see, and sometimes that can be asymptomatic. And in those patients, then, you know, you just say, let's just watch this. If you're not symptomatic, then a lot of those patients can do fine for a long time. But once you're symptomatic, you're kind of on the train, so to speak, and that inflammation has started, the apoptosis, and you're starting to have some spinal cord damage that is showing up on your symptoms or on your exam. And at that point, you know, kind of the clock has started. It's not an urgent thing. It's not like I see someone in clinic with myelopathy and it's, wow, we need to get this taken care of right away. It's something that you discuss surgery and maybe within the next couple months, 2-3 months, you go ahead and try to get it taken care of for most patients. Of course, rarely maybe someone would get acutely worse, but typically it's just kind of going to be this slow process. You have time to treat it. But I think that typically we think about treatment being indicated for these patients.
Yeah, I think my first patient of the day tomorrow says neck pain on the list. I'm not joking. And, you know, now I'm going to be thinking about this tomorrow. But yeah. It seems like, I mean, we can't be missing like millions of these cases, you know, right? But this is something we should be aware of. I mean, in my experience, most of the patients coming in with neck pain have non-specific neck pain or radiculopathy, fortunately, because I do feel, especially after having talked with you about them, much more comfortable. This one, I still feel like if we suspect this is going on, we would maybe jump to imaging sooner than we would. Like we don't necessarily have to wait the 6 weeks with these people. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think, again, the approach of these people is just getting a good history. And one thing that can guide your history is something called the Modified Japanese Orthopedic Association score, or Modified JOA score. That's something that, if you look at all the trials, that's typically a questionnaire that people fill out that gauges their degree of myelopathy. And so if you look at the guidelines, someone with mild myelopathy might be someone who has a little bit of difficulty buttoning their shirts. Maybe they're a little unsteady on their feet, but they can still walk independently. And if you look at the guidelines that were published back in 2017, this is, you know, accumulating all the data, which is some small randomized studies, mostly large prospective international studies. Those patients get the least benefit from surgery. And just to back up, you can kind of say patients with myelopathy, I could talk about myelopathy all day, but I'll try to boil it down. And that, you know, everyone, people who you operate on who have myelopathy, on average, they will get a little bit better no matter where they're at, if you look at the data. So if you have mild myelopathy, you're going to probably end up mild or maybe near perfect and get a little bit better. If you have moderate, maybe you'll get towards mild. And then if you have severe myelopathy, maybe you'll get back up to moderate. But typically, you know, it's not like you take patients who are in a wheelchair, you operate on them, and they're going to get back to 100% normal, because throughout this process, some irreversible damage occurs in the spinal cord. So if you look at mild myelopathy patients, they get the least benefit in terms of JOA score, but you're preventing them from getting to the moderate or severe level. So you're not waiting until that reversible damage has happened. And the flip side of that is, of course, if you look at the severe patients, those patients maybe get the most benefit in terms of they gain the most JOA points. Their symptoms improve the most if you look at the scale on average, but they're not getting back to normal or mild, you know? So the guidelines say for mild myelopathy, I think, you know, from a clinic standpoint, those patients should go on to get referred MRI if you suspect that. And then from a surgical standpoint, you kind of discuss surgery versus no surgery. But the guidelines say in those patients who you don't offer surgery to, if they don't get better, then you should do surgery, which these patients typically don't get better. So kind of all roads kind of end up leading towards surgery. And a lot of really good surgeons who I really trust, you know, will typically say, once you're symptomatic, you're kind of on that train. And the only way to get off the myelopathy train is to have surgery, unfortunately. And then the guidelines say pretty clearly, if you have moderate and severe myelopathy, those patients you definitely offer surgery to.
This is going to sound like a dumb question, but again, that's kind of my role here. So with the MRI, are there any buzzwords? Yeah, I think the reports will read myelopathy sometimes, but are there any other anatomic findings or changes on the report that should sort of prompt us to think, oh no, or sort of be panicked? Like myelomalacia is a term that I've seen that I'm never quite sure what it means, but what on an MRI report would be reflective of myelopathy or should raise your eyebrows a little bit more than some of the bread and butter degenerative findings?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Myelomalacia is, you know, I typically tell patients, you know, because they come in with their radiology report and they say, I have all these findings. And I typically tell them, you know, my job isn't to treat the imaging, it's to treat the patient. And so that's where you really see, you know, is any of the symptomatic that we see on our MRI? Because again, anyone over the age of 30 is going to have some finding on their MRI. But myelomalacia is one, which is where you're seeing some sickness within the cord, which is a T2 hyperintensity, a bright spot within the cord. And if you see that, then that is a sign on imaging that some damage has already occurred within the cord. So that is a pretty good indicator, especially in a patient who isn't, you know, extremely old and extremely sick. That's a pretty good indicator to go ahead and think about surgery as well. But in absence of that, you know, it's a pretty common consult for us to see patient with really bad cervical stenosis, narrowing, no myelomalacia, no bright spot. And then you talk to the patient and they have no symptoms, nothing on exam. They're totally normal. And in those patients, we typically watch them. We say, okay, we'll see you back in 6 months. Let us know if anything gets worse. But, you know, we know from the data about 25% of those patients will progress to being symptomatic in 4 years. But a lot of those patients will do just fine. So I say, let's just wait, you know, and if you start to develop symptoms, then we'll hopefully catch it early and then we can go ahead and treat it. And the most likely outcome is that, you know, you're going to have a little bit of improvement and probably get back to near normal if we catch it early enough.
So it sounds like Paul and I, if we're suspicious we have a case of myelopathy, or if we've got an imaging and we know we have a case of myelopathy, there's not a whole lot we can really offer where we should be referring them on. Is that correct? Or is there anything you recommend an internist listening to this should do if they think they have a case?
I don't think so. I think, unfortunately, it's one of those disease processes where the spinal cord is being pinched. The only treatment is to unpinch it. I wish there was something easier that we had that we could do. But yeah, I think if you have a patient in your clinic who you're worried that they may have myelopathy, I think go ahead and get the MRI. And if it shows stenosis, central stenosis, then go ahead and refer them for a surgical opinion. You know, it's not an urgent thing. Again, sometimes we'll see patients will get an MRI in clinic and it'll show cervical stenosis, and those patients will get called and sent to the ER, immediately to go be seen for like emergency surgery. And, that we see the patients in the ER and they're asymptomatic, or minimally symptomatic maybe. And, and then it's like, hey, we'll see you back in clinic and, nothing urgent to do, which is fine. Of course, we're always happy to see patients in the ER as well. And sometimes it's tough to know what's going on, and better safe than sorry. But I think in general, just know that in the absence of some real profound progressive neurologic deficit, even if you think myelopathy might be going on, we have time. We can all take a deep breath and just kind of get the imaging and get the referral and just let the process carry through.
Paul, do you think we're ready for take-home points? You have more questions?
No, I think we saved all the Joneses. I feel good about it. So we'll say we referred this Ms. Jones to surgery. She did great and had improvement in her symptoms and not progressed anything catastrophic. So let's give her a happy ending. And yeah, Tony, if you want to give us your take-home points for neck pain, what you really like our listeners to come away with, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, of course. I think the main take-home points, I think knowing that neck pain is often self-limited and will get better on its own. And I think that without any of the major red flags, myelopathy, long extended time of radiculopathy, I think advanced imaging probably not necessary for the majority of patients, again, unless they have cancer history or some other, these other things that we talked about. Reassurance is probably key, self-limited. I think as well for radiculopathy, kind of our second bucket, the majority of those patients will get better without surgery as well and just kind of work through some of the non-operative measures, give it time. And I think a lot of those patients don't even need imaging. You know, if they have pretty classic radiculopathy, pain, I think let's give it some time and just, counseling the patients that this is probably going to get better on its own. And if it doesn't, then we have some non-operative things we can try. And if none of those work, then surgery is kind of a last resort for a select number of patients. And then myelopathy is something that requires a high index of suspicion. I think that catching it early is important. And I think that those patients, if they're symptomatic, I think that the main goal of surgery is to preserve wherever they're at. And so if they're good going into surgery, then they're probably, their end outcome is going to be good. So trying to catch them before they, fall into kind of more severe myelopathy, mm-hmm. I think is a goal.
Excellent.
Tony, this is great. Thank you so much. A really clear framework for everything, and that's great. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I could talk about this stuff all night. So really appreciate you guys having me on the show. This was a lot of fun.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
Still hungry for more?
Tried to power through.
I don't know why I just powered through, but you got it in there anyway. So just for the listeners at home, Matt said yummy, and now you heard me say it too. Still hungry for more? Join our Patreon and get all of our episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find our show notes at thecurbsiders.com and sign up for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox. This includes our Curbsiders Digest, which recaps the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine.
And we're committed to high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and we want your feedback, so please email us at askcurbsiders@gmail.com. It also helps a lot when you subscribe, rate, and review the show on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. A special thanks to our writer and producer for this episode, Dr. Paul Nelson-Williams, and to our whole Curbsiders team. Our technical production is done by Podpace. Elizabeth Proto does social media. Jen Watto does Patreon. Krista Chumanchu moderates our Discord. And Stuart Brigham composed our theme music. And with all that, until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
And as always, our main Dr. Paul Nelson-Williams. Thank you and goodbye.